you know, I had something to, like, give back to the world, even though, like, I didn't have much myself.
Welcome to the Telling It Our Way podcast. I'm Allie.
And I'm Becca.
In this podcast, we bring you stories by disabled people about disabled people. Stories from the daily lives of self-advocates with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
These are real people with complicated lives. They don't want your pity, and they don't exist to inspire you.
This is not inspiration porn.
Hey, Allie.
Hey, Becca. What do you have up your sleeve today?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. So today, we have two stories connecting this idea of finding your voice, right? And both of our storytellers just happen to be artists as well. And this plays into their experiences about how they learn to speak up for themselves and for other disabled people.
I love it when we can feature storytellers like this, people who identify as self-advocates. And I know we've mentioned this on our show before, and we certainly use the term in our introduction, but I'm not always certain, really, that our listeners know what self-advocates are. Can you remind us, Becca?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, on one level, self-advocacy is exactly what it sounds like, right? Being able to speak up for what you need. This can be in your day-to-day life, like getting the support you need, living where you want, eating the foods you like. But on another level, self-advocacy is about pushing for these broader changes that improve the lives of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, you know, more broadly, advocating for policy and program changes, especially when those policies affect people's own lives. And the self-advocacy movement for people with intellectual disabilities, we can trace that back to the 60s. So let me give you a little history lesson.
Oh, I love this.
At this time, in the 1960s, we see many people are leaving institutions for the first time. We're also getting this new generation of folks who are living in the community from the outset. And so we have this group in Sweden, the Swedish Associations of Persons with Intellectual Disabilities, who start pushing for this new idea, this idea of the dignity of risk, meaning that people should be able to make their own decisions, even if those decisions mean they might fail, and that being allowed to try and maybe fail, that's what real independence is. And so people with developmental disabilities start organizing around these ideas. They're forming organizations. They're hosting conferences. They're training each other on how to push for their rights to make decisions. And we get the birth of all of these great organizations like People First, which is now an international collection of self-advocates with intellectual disabilities, and other organizations like the Self-Advocates Becoming Empowered. And the rest is history.
And I love that we see this organizing happen really from beginning at the grassroots level with like people with intellectual disabilities recognizing a need to come together and to organize and pulling strategies from all sorts of other kinds of movements, right? And contributing to other movements as well with the strategies that they're building. And I really want to believe that all disabled people are participating in shared decision-making process where they are formally making decisions alongside their care staff. But even today, in 2026, that isn't always happening, is it?
No, unfortunately not, right? So, I mean, we can look at some of the data, right? So the 2018 National Core Indicators Survey said that only about 24% of disabled people nationwide feel like they have the opportunity to participate in self-advocacy. And that's even though there are more than 1,200 self-advocacy groups for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities across the U.S. And what we know is that when people do have the opportunity to participate in self-advocacy, that we can see the results in their lives. Those people feel like they have significantly more power in those critical life choices, like choosing their own home, their housemates, their staff, their schedule, how they spend their money. And so we can see self-advocacy pays off in people's quality of life.
I think it's really interesting, too, if we dig a tiny bit into these stats, that there's an interesting gender breakdown that 60% of people who identify as self-advocates are women, and that many, many of these are people 22 to 26 years old, that age range is disproportionately represented among self-advocates.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a couple reasons for that, right? So one is possibly just people growing up in sort of a post-Americans with Disabilities Act world. It might also have to do with the fact that that 22 to 26 year old age range is sometimes this transition age, which there are a lot of programs and funding that go toward those programs. And so thinking about kind of how do we make self-advocacy programs more sustainable for older adults, that's something that we need to think about too. It could also just have to do with having more energy as a young person, right?
Yeah, maybe fewer responsibilities in terms of caretaking as a younger person too. Mm. Well, our first storyteller, Alicia, she shares her experience jumping into statewide advocacy. Let's listen.
My name is Alicia Hopkins, and I use art to advocate in a way that is different and unique. So I use art to advocate for myself on a daily basis to problem solve and process information. But I've also used art to advocate for others. And one of the biggest ways that I use art to advocate for others is through using art for storytelling and for advocacy purposes. And at one point in my life, I was like going through a care crisis. And so I painted to survive in my care crisis, but also I started finding that there were other people that were going through the similar care crisis that I was going through. And so I started asking people if I could paint their stories. And so in 2 years, I painted 25 feet of art about the Ohio direct support crisis. And then I started finding that art was really impactful in not just my life, but my art was like impacting people and it was helping people be heard. So I led a workshop called Creative Changemakers, and I had people paint about like what it was like having care and not having care. And then I took those people's art and my own art and I turned it into postcards. And I traveled Ohio during the 2023 budget season. I traveled Ohio and I basically had people write like postcards, and I took it, I turned art into postcards, and then I took the postcards and I traveled to 15 Ohio counties where I had people write letters to legislators in a campaign called Dear Ohio Legislators. And then I took the postcards and I scanned them as public testimony. Then I also hand delivered them. Some of them we mailed them to legislators, showing like the impact of the care crisis both through art and through storytelling. And then so I've used art in that way to advocate for change, and that was one of the most ways I've used art. But I've also used art like through like charting the life course. I painted my integrated support stars, and I've to like be able to like shape my Ohio ISP planning recently, and use art to talk about communication and other things as well.
So, Alicia, could you, just for people who don't know, explain what the care crisis is?
The Ohio direct care crisis has a lot to do with low wages for providers on some sides of it, but there's many sides to the care crisis. Some of it has to do also with, like, contracting of providers and, like, systematic problems that exist within the care crisis. I was once on a waiver called MyCare Ohio before I got the Ohio Developmental Disabilities Individual Options waiver. So it looks, the care crisis looks different from many different points, and many people wouldn't know this. So some of it has to do with low pay, like agencies paying workers really low wages, but then there's parts of it too where it's hard to get workers paid in a timely crisis, in a timely period of time. Like when I was going through my care crisis, one of my caregivers went 471 days without pay, and you know that was a long time for me to go through. But and I had challenges getting workers contracted through the managed care plans in the state of Ohio, and it made it so I didn't get care. I was on a 300-day backup plan. Some people in the state haven't like really had adequate care for years. And then there's the DD side of the care crisis where there's agencies can't recruit quality providers or people that really have work ethic. And so some agencies, I went through periods where some agencies were working people in my house like 24 to 72 hours because they couldn't recruit people because of the low wages. So there's many different parts of the care crisis, but not all of it's really been explored or talked about. Most people just hear about the low wages, but they don't hear the side of what it takes to like get providers on boarded, or the pay problems that have existed in the state's Medicaid system, and you know, just the recruiting processes. So there's a lot of different parts to it. And so I went to Columbus and I took a lot of my art and talked to legislators and told people stories. That was just something that's been a very important thing for me, to tell people stories. So each person in my art pieces that I have, the artwork I've done, every single person is someone's actual story. I painted real, it's been really important for me to paint the real lived experiences of people with disabilities. Like I had people give me photographs and everything of them so I could try to get as close as possible. I mean, I don't paint faces but on people, but, you know, and I put like 3 to 5 sentences about the care crisis, and I interviewed people like providers and stuff, because the care crisis doesn't just affect people with disabilities, but it also affects our providers when they can't get paid, they can't provide for their families, you know, when there's delays in pay, when there's contracting issues, auditing problems. I mean, there's many systemic problems in the care that's made care complicated, and so I've been using my art for years to advocate for that systemic change.
So could you just describe what one of these pieces looked like?
My very first piece that I had made had a human heart in the middle of it, and it had, I did like the institutional side of care, where because the care crisis is also in developmental centers and ICFs, but I also did the community side of care as well. And so there's a lot of people and like a city built in. I have some hands that are multicolored, reaching down into the one piece, because I believe that these issues impact people from all different cultures and backgrounds, and it's not just single to like one person. Issues affect people from all different backgrounds, and so that's basically what it has. There's like red and green and some yellow into it. That's one of them, but that was the first piece I made. And then the very last piece I made, I want to talk about this because it's really significant. So the very last piece I made was the legislator sitting on the money, and that was during the budget. And I made that piece because I really felt like the legislators were just really whole. Back in 2023, you know, workers were only making $11, $12 an hour, and we were an independent provider, so it was really hard to recruit people at that time for, like, for less than $12 an hour. I had a really hard time recruiting workers, and so I wanted to make a big statement about how, you know, that they had a lot of red tape in it. My last one was mainly about the nursing crisis, because there are a lot of kids with disabilities that need ventilator and trach care in our state. And that's also part of the direct care crisis, is the lack of nurses. And so I wanted them to not even just increase the wages for direct support providers, but I wanted them to increase the nursing wages as well, because I think it's a unified effort to raise awareness about the fact that we also have a lot of people that need nursing care at home in the community as well.
You said when you were sharing your story that you decided to paint to survive your own care crisis. Can you explain what you mean by that?
I was going through my own care crisis, and basically I went from July of 2021 to May of 2022 with like pretty much no care. I had a church person come in that came in like a couple hours. My church hired somebody to come in a couple hours with me, but I literally needed, at the time I was on the MyCare Ohio waiver, and I was getting 8 hours, supposed to get 8 hours a day of care. And when my caregiver didn't get paid, he'd come like once a week because he wasn't getting paid, he couldn't survive. And so I was just by myself most of the time. And I actually had fallen into like a depression, and because my needs were not met, I was going days without taking showers, and I had a lot of emergency room trips. It was a really hard thing. But then I started connecting to like other people with disabilities going to peer support groups, and that was where I found like that hearing other people's stories, I wanted to, you know, paint about them. And I have this love for art and how it communicates. So I just literally, you know, hearing other people's stories and asking people for their stories kind of gave me hope that I wasn't alone in that. And so I would just paint, like when I didn't have care and I needed care, I would just sit in my bed and paint That was all I could do that day. That's what I would do. And eventually, as I started, you know, times I had more fear, I would go and advocate with my art. I mean, it was just a way to, like, help me. Art helped me cope, and it helped me find my voice and to really, really kind of see a new, like, light to my life, because I had a, you know, I had something to, like, give back to the world, even though, like, I didn't have much myself.
I'm so grateful for Alicia's advocacy here and excited to keep in touch to learn about what she might be working on next. But I also love that her story is about art. And when we talk about self-advocacy, we often talk about, like, voices and being heard. But Alicia's story is a great reminder that you don't have to be speaking to be a self-advocate, that there are so many ways to communicate your message. But, you know, for our listeners, Becca, who may have never gotten involved with statewide advocacy, do you have any advice or suggestions on how to get your feet wet or your wheels wet with this process?
Yes, I do. This can be so intimidating, right? This idea that, like, I can go to my representative and say something to them. But many states have organized advocacy days where they invite people with developmental disabilities and their families to visit state representatives. They'll help you organize those meetings, prepare what you should say, give you a rundown of what to expect. And it's also a really great opportunity to meet other people who are interested in policy change. And I've gone to several of these events in the past, and I just think they're so helpful. I know, for example, Ohio every March hosts a Developmental Disabilities Awareness and Advocacy Day at the State House specifically to introduce people on how to do this kind of work at the state level.
Yeah. And, you know, I ask you, Becca, because I know that you teach college classes that are about advocacy and self-advocates. And a big important part of that is working with future social workers and other care providers to recognize the importance of self-advocacy for disabled people so that they don't just sort of go into their work and speak for them.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think that connects so well to our next story. So our next storyteller comes to us through a local organization here in Ohio called Sunshine. And like many organizations that take some of their organizational models from the disability rights and independent living movements, this organization has an advisory board that's made up in part of the people that they serve, like Melissa.
My name is Melissa Gender. I like watching TV, reading books, spending time with family, and I also enjoy working. My first memory of Sunshine is almost 15 years ago. I distinctly remember the atmosphere. I was nervous at first. Who isn't? But it was like home. Everyone was friendly. I was working in the laundry department. My first day, I got picked up by a van, and they dropped me off. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know anybody. But they were like, it's okay. Everyone is nervous. And they talked me through what I was going to be doing. And it turned out to be a very nice day. And then I went on the bus to go home. Everyone here is very friendly. If it takes a little longer to get something down, that's okay. They're patient and welcoming and kind, the staff especially. They make it easy for us, especially for us that can be nervous around people that we're not normally around. At first, I was one of those people. Now ask anyone and they'll tell you Melissa is a friendly one. That change has to do with the staff. Not only do they help with the job atmosphere, but they also help with your everyday life to be as independent as you can be. A few years ago, after I started, they started an art program here. At first, it was just a class one day a week. I wasn't really artistic, but I really enjoyed doing it. And the art teacher who started just made it fun. She said, you don't have to be artistic to have fun with art. And she wasn't judgmental, and that drew me in. I have been with the art program for more than 10 years. I love making things here and seeing the people enjoy them. We did that. We started the art program. in just one room with one kiln, and it grew into this big building that we're in now. I sometimes still don't think of myself as an artist, but the job coaches say, don't be so hard on yourself. You've grown. So it's just about having confidence in myself. Like, I've got this. When someone says, I really like what you've done, I wouldn't have thought to do that. I think, okay, maybe I can do this. I am more open now, more willing to take things as they come, trying new things. At first, I felt like I couldn't do it, but I think I've grown out of my shell. For example, when we first started making our clay garden flowers, I traced them out and then molded them in the shape of flowers and laid them over a few bowls to get the shape of the flower. I got it and traced and pinched the edges of the clay. But when it came to putting the petals on the bowl, I just couldn't seem to get it down. I thought, I want to do this, but I can't. I don't want to do this. Why bother working on something I'm not going to get? I was frustrated and disappointed. The more I couldn't do it, the more frustrated I would get. My job coach would tell me, calm down, take a break, you'll get it. And then I would come back at it. And the more that I worked on it, the better I got at it. And now I can put more than one flower together myself. And now I feel really good. If I'm asked to make them now, I think I got this. After a while, people just started coming up to me and asking, hey, Melissa, how did you do that? And so now I start showing new people what to do at the studio. For example, I've shown a number of people how to put the flowers together or our succulent houses. When we get new people who might want to work there, they come in and usually I'm asked to work with them. They let me know what they want the person to do and we work on it. Whether it's rolling out a piece of clay on the slab roller or painting something that's already bisque, sometimes giving them a tour. I feel good that they trust me to show someone how to do it. I've been shown how to do it, and it's nice to feel that I can do something like that and be trusted like that. Over a year ago, the Sunshine manager came to me and said, hey, would you be interested in being a voice on the board for the individuals? Even as someone who is nervous talking to people I don't know, I didn't hesitate to say yes. I just thought it was a good opportunity to be a voice for individuals who are like how I used to be, nervous to speak up or say certain things. I personally feel that sometimes people with disabilities can be afraid to say something is wrong or that they want something to change. They might feel like it can't change or know how to go about seeing if it can be changed. If they can go to some people, they might not feel like they are being heard. Being a voice for them, even if it is something that can't be changed, I can be like, well, what can we do to make you feel better about it? Sometimes I feel like people with disabilities aren't given credit or understood. They can be underestimated or seem like they can't understand certain things when actually if you just talk to them, they can understand. You just have to communicate it in a different way. We're just not given the credit we deserve sometimes.
I think it is a really important distinction that Melissa makes at the end here. This distinction between being able to change something that isn't working, but also working to feel better about something that isn't immediately changeable.
What I also love about what Melissa highlights here is that she's showing leadership all along in her story, but she didn't necessarily see that in herself. She has these other people, though, around who are encouraging her and acknowledging what she's doing already. And that becomes this really important part of her growing into her confidence. And I also think that this thing that she says about being able to support people who are shy or feel that they can't speak up for themselves, that that's something she can do because she's experienced that herself. And it's a really great example of why it's important to have people with lived experience in leadership roles. And we know that hasn't historically been the case for people with developmental disabilities. And in fact, it can still be quite rare to see people with developmental disabilities on executive boards or in leadership and advisory roles. And we've got a lot of work to do, right? But stories like Melissa's and Alicia's show us why that work is important.
Definitely does. As we end, I want to thank our contributors, Alicia and Melissa, and our associate producer, Connor Smenner, and our Telling It Our Way advisory board members, Dorita Fox, Quinn Thomas, and Gavin Daly.
And special thanks to WGTE and our producer, Chris Pfeiffer. To access transcripts for this show and any other show notes, please visit wgte.org/ourway.
I'm Allie Day.
And I'm Becca Monsalian. And you've been listening to Telling It Our Way.
WGTE. Voices around us.